Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Another potential war in the Middle East has everyone talking once again about oil. The price at the pump for a gallon of gasoline has risen to over $2 in many places. And President Bush, an oil man, spoke recently about a hydrogen fuel initiative, his plan for cutting back our dependency on foreign oil.
We must make hydrogen more plentiful and produce it in the most efficient, cost-effective way. That is one of our challenges. We must lower the cost of fuel cells so that the automobile can compete. The cost of the automobile is cost effective. We must increase the capacity of hydrogen storage systems. And we put in place the infrastructure to get hydrogen to the consumers. There'd be nothing worse than developing a car and having no place for somebody to find the fuel. People aren't going to buy many cars if they can't refuel their car.
This hour, we'll talk about those fuel cells and a path toward a hydrogen economy. We'll also get reaction to the president's speech. Is it a good step forward? Does it go far enough? We'll talk about hydrogen and other alternative power sources like wind, biomass, solar, and nuclear. How might all this be put together to create a hydrogen economy? What do you think? If you want to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Peter Hoffman is the editor of the Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Letter and author of Tomorrow's Energy, Hydrogen, Fuel Cells, and Prospects for a Cleaner Planet, out on MIT Press. Susan Hock, she's the director of the Electric and Hydrogen Technologies and Systems Center at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. She was also the lab's wind energy technology manager from 1992 to 2002. She joins us from our studios at member station KCFR in Denver. Alan Lloyd is chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership, a collaborative of auto manufacturers, energy companies, fuel cell companies, and government agencies working to advance new vehicle technology. He's also chairman of the California Air Resources Board. He joins us from the studios of member station KUNR in Reno, Nevada. Welcome all to the program. Let me begin, Peter Hoffman. What is your reaction to the president's energy independence speech?
Well, I was happy to hear, to tell the truth. I didn't quite expect it until I heard about a day before or so. I must tell you, hydrogen supporters have been calling for top-level government support, both in Europe and in the United States, for decades until they were blue in the face, but nothing much ever happened. The Clinton administration did talk about hydrogen, did do things, did have some programs going, which are quite good. But the kind of visibility that comes from a State of the Union message, and where you get three or four paragraphs on the subject, I think it was absolutely great, and was the kind of kick, if you will, that was needed. I know there are many people are saying that's great and that's the future and that's partially a fig leaf, etc., and we should do something about improving conventional technologies, internal combustion engine technologies right now, which some car makers are doing to quite some extent. I seem to see. But in the grand scheme of things, I think it was a wonderful thing.
Alan Lloyd, any comment?
No, I was highly encouraged as well. I think this is something we've been pushing for in California and through in the Fuel Cell Partnership for a number of years. And to see the leadership from the president working through the Department of Energy, I thought was highly encouraging, and I'm really excited with the prospect of working together with them and our partners in the partnership.
Susan Hock, you know, I was a little confused, let me put it that way. You focus on renewable energy, and President Bush talked about natural gas, coal, and even nuclear power as a source for hydrogen, but little mention was made of wind, solar, or other renewables. Were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't that surprised. I think if you look at the transition to a hydrogen economy over many years, the ultimate goal will be to produce it from renewable sources. But the pathway to get there will have to rely on many of these other sources that you just suggested.
So you're saying that pathway will have to start with getting hydrogen from gasoline or methane or other ways like that we use fossil fuels now?
That's correct. We have an infrastructure in place today to produce hydrogen from natural gas for many of the chemical processing plants and food processing, and we need to build off that current infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Peter Hoffman, let's start laying out how we might head toward a new infrastructure. Give us a bit of a roadmap of how we're going to get there.
Oh, boy. As Susan just said, part of it will be to draw on existing infrastructure facilities. There is surplus merchant hydrogen available at various refineries and chemical factories at various facilities. That might be one start. Another start would be a number of companies are working on developing small reformer stations, which you could build, which you could add, for example, to existing gasoline station, which could reform natural gas, which is probably the principal transitional feedstock for hydrogen. You could build these reformer stations at gasoline stations, and provide hydrogen that way for the growing number of fuel cell or hydrogen vehicles running on internal combustion engines. I think there are many, many pathways of doing this. John Ogden, who's probably the best known analyst systems analyst of how to get there. I seem to remember her saying at one point in one of her papers, there are many, many ways of getting there. If there are existing hydrogen pipelines, there are some in California and elsewhere, you tap into those, perhaps, if you can, because there is an infrastructure. Other places where there's plenty, a great supply of hydropower, for example, you can try to tap into that and make hydrogen there. There's no single way, apparently, of getting there. There are many ways which depend on the local economic and technical circumstances and what's available locally. And it could be individual small stations or a centralized large depot, all sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm. President, an administration spokesman, Robert Card, who's part of the Department of Energy, he's Undersecretary of Energy for Energy Science and Environment, testified on Capitol Hill on February 13th. And he laid out a groundwork for what this budget that the president submitted was. And he seemed to indicate that one of the main paths for getting to hydrogen was nuclear power, and that the president was investing now or wanted to invest in creating nuclear power plants that would create hydrogen out of water. Does that seem like a viable, a feasible way to go for you?
It's been looked at a long time ago, back in the 70s. There was thought given to developing high-temperature reactors which could produce hydrogen either via electricity, via electrolysis, but also via direct thermochemical water splitting, which is a way of basically splitting water or steam, really, at very high temperatures. Technically, I suppose it's doable. My concern is the popular perception of nuclear power as something which we really don't want in our backyard. Also, I remember going to an investors conference last summer, and I talked to a utility executive, and they said, well, the cost of building new nuclear power plants is really very, very high. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was multiples of building power plants based on oil or natural gas, for example. So I'm not sure whether, you know, the industry is willing to embrace that, the utility industry is willing to embrace that and lay out that kind of money. I just don't know.
Susan Hawk, is it possible to do it with other renewables like wind and solar?
Well, certainly. I think that there's multiple sources for producing hydrogen. And even the renewable resources in this country with wind or solar or biomass, we could produce a significant portion of our hydrogen needs.
Mm-hmm. Alan Lloyd, California is always seen as the test bed, shall I put it, for the future of technology in lots of different areas. Eventually leaks across the rest of the country. What is going on in California now with hydrogen and fuel cell cars?
Well, I think we have this exciting partnership where we have 8 automakers, we have 4 energy companies, 6 government agencies, and we have 10 associate partners, all focused on voluntarily working together again on a common vision to commercialize fuel cell vehicles by the 21st century. And I think that's a very exciting program. We are looking at all the sources, the ways of looking at hydrogen, trying to get a hydrogen infrastructure out there. Clearly that's a key. And when we talk about the federal dollars, I think I don't want to give the impression that that's enough, but it's a great start. We need to build on that. I think, as Susan said, the idea that you can get hydrogen from a variety of sources, which is one of the beauties, all the way from renewables, and we have renewable stations operating in California where we have the electrolysis of water to produce hydrogen. We're using natural gas, we're using methanol. We can use offboard reforming of gasoline, any hydrocarbon fuels. So I think we're actually getting cars on the road. By the end of this year, we hope to have 60 fuel cell cars on the road. Two of the companies, Honda and Toyota, actually have cars, fuel cell cars, in public hands. So I think you see a lot of activity going on. I encourage anybody who's really interested to visit the website of the partnership and to come out and drive these vehicles. We've had a tremendous number of people looking at the vehicles. We've had over 200,000 people directly acquainted with fuel cells over the past year. More than 5,000 of those have actually been driven fuel cell vehicles. So I think that, again, I think we're trying to push the technology in cooperation with all the other stakeholders, which is a critical aspect.
I'm sorry, Peter, do you want to jump in there?
Well, if I may, just for a second, Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are also the first hydrogen stations that dispense hydrogen to cars, fuel cells, or whatever, are coming up, springing up in the L.A. Basin. I believe the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which is the clean air watchdog for the Los Angeles Basin, they have plans underway to build or design or build anywhere, I think it's between 12 and 50, maybe 20 hydrogen stations in various parts of the Los Angeles Basin. So, you know, this is gradually spreading outward from there, as you were saying. That is correct, Alan.
Yes, I think what we're doing, we're spreading south and north and then linking the two.
Yeah.
But obviously, to make this a national program, we have to work with the other states. That's where the federal agencies come in. So, in fact, we can put the infrastructure in for the rest of the nation. And that's a very key part.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Do you have to be able to pump it and pipe it throughout the country? Does that infrastructure already exist?
Well, I don't think you have to pipe it. You can generate it on site. As we're saying, we've got the variety of sources, either renewably, but you've got natural gas, you've got water for electrolysis, reformed natural gas, reformed methanol, other hydrocarbon fuels. You can use wind, solar, any other renewable sources for electricity, and then use electrolysis. So I think those can be used on site. Where there's excess hydrogen available, clearly that can be used.
Susan, can you set up, basically simply set up a windmill? And I was out at your shop last week in Colorado. I was just amazed at the state of wind turbine technology, putting out over a million watts of some of these turbines. Can you just set one up and just bubble off hydrogen out of water and then transport it someplace?
Well, yes. Of course, you'd want to install your wind turbines in places where you have a good wind resource. Mm-hmm. But theoretically, yeah, if you've got a good wind resource, you can put up a wind turbine or a wind farm and install an electrolyzer and produce hydrogen right there.
And get into business that way.
That's right. You can either have distributed generation where you would have your wind turbine and your electrolyzer maybe at a fueling station where you need to produce the hydrogen, or you could have more of a central site and then distribute it in a regional location that way.
Which do you think would be the better way of going?
Well, there's economies of scale that apply differently for different technologies. I know for wind, it's less expensive if you can have a group of larger machines together. But if you have to transport the hydrogen, that's another cost. So I think you'd have to do a pretty detailed cost trade-off study to look at what would be optimum.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with my guest, Peter Hoffman, who is author of Tomorrow's Energy, Hydrogen, Fuel Cells, and Prospects for a Cleaner Planet. Susan Hawk, who's director of the Electric and Hydrogen Technologies and Systems Center at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Alan Lloyd, chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership, also chairman of the California Air Resources Board. Lots of your questions. Stay on the line. We'll be back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about a hydrogen economy. Taking your questions and answers with my guests, Peter Hoffman, Susan Hawk, Alan Lloyd. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Susan Hawk, explain to those of us who don't know what a fuel cell is. Why is it such a wonderful device for energy?
Well, fuel cells are great because basically, the first thing is there's no emissions besides water. I think that's the number one attraction, but also their efficiency can be about twice of what we're expecting now from internal combustion engines.
And how does it work?
Whoa. You know what? I don't have a good background to explain that. I'd pass that
Peter,
question.
Peter, you want to explain it?
Oh, God, no. But I'll try anyway.
I don't need to have the exact explanation. Just a simple explanation.
It's basically, all right. One way of explaining is it's an electrochemical process in which hydrogen and oxygen from the air combine with the assistance of a catalyst to make electricity. What happens is the hydrogen is fed into the fuel cell. There's a membrane in the middle and a catalyst. And Alan, you can correct me. You're the scientist. I'm not.
Yeah.
It's this membrane. The hydrogen atom molecule is broken up into electrons and protons. The electrons migrate outwardly around a circuit, outward and around the fuel cell. And in the process, this is the electricity, really. And that does the actual work. It runs a light bulb or electric motor or a car or whatever. It comes around again to the other side after it has done that work to the other side of the fuel cell where it recombines with the air's oxygen to form water plus some heat. And that's a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of looking at it is we're all familiar with electrolysis. Electrolysis is basically the technology, the lab experiment where you run a current through water, and on one end you get hydrogen, H2O is water, you get hydrogen, H out of one end of that setup, and oxygen from the other side of that setup. And a fuel cell is really...
Just the reverse of that.
Yeah,
so if you take a battery and you put the electrodes, the plus and minus, in the water, one side comes out hydrogen and one side comes out oxygen. So if you just reverse it, if you put hydrogen and oxygen together, you get that electricity going coming out that you originally would have put in.
Yeah,
it sort of reverses that.
Yin and yang, if you will.
Yeah.
You know.
Except you get the oxygen from the air.
From the air, that's right, yes.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can. A lot of people want to ask questions about this. Let's go to the phone. Let's take line six. Scott in Seattle. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Great. And first of all, I'd like to really thank you all for doing this show, and I'd love to really thank you and congratulate the people that are on this show because they're icons in this world, and they're really creating a global community. My statement is this, simply, is that there cannot be, and I'll repeat that, there cannot be hydrogen fuel cell made from oil, natural gas, or any carbon-based products. That will send us backwards so far. Hydrogen fuel should only be produced by renewable energy. Otherwise, what we're accomplishing and what we're going to try to do will just set us back eons.
You mean because you'll be releasing the carbon out of the gasoline or other fossil fuels?
Exactly. I mean, this war that we're about to face and all the problems that are, like, you know, inundated us in our society today are because of carbon-based fuels. We need to get away from those, and then we can start to look at ourselves and be proud that we are actually using our intelligence as human beings to progress forward.
But what about in the interim? What about you hear the president saying that I think eventually he wants to get past that, but he's saying in the near term, just to get the system going, we may have to depend on natural gas. It doesn't have any carbon in it, but it has nitrates in it.
Well,
just oxides in it.
You know, our president, I'll try to be really quick about this, but, you know, he failed a lot of grades in school, and he's not the most intelligent rabbit in the cage, okay? So if we're going to start to develop opinions based upon his opinions, we're really going to be in trouble.
Not making this up himself, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either.
Peter, what do you think?
Well, in principle, yes. You know, in principle, we should not depend on fossil fuels to make hydrogen. However, there are gradations. There are fossil fuels and there are fossil fuels. Some people years ago developed this progression of fossil fuels. On one end, you have wood and coal, lots of carbon, little hydrogen. Then you have oil, more hydrogen, less carbon. Then at the extreme of the fossil fuels, at the upper end, you have lots and lots of hydrogen and very little carbon. I think as a transitional step to produce hydrogen from, let's say, natural gas, which has lots of hydrogen, little carbon, makes some sense as an interim step because it's a reasonably clean fuel. If you use it in a fuel cell, which, as Susan said, have twice the efficiency of internal combustion engines, you're going a long ways. And hydrogen and the natural gas is to a large measure, if I understand this correctly, available domestically without having to go to Saudi Arabia for that. So it would make some sense to gradually move in that direction by using what you have and use the best possible, okay, fossil fuel that would lend itself to for this purpose. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think anybody can see the United States or any country in the world, or the world as such, switching overnight from total fossil dependency to total solar independence, to total solar or other renewable primary sources to make hydrogen. So there has to be a transitional phase, it seems to me, for logistical and technical and money reasons as well, capital. You need capital to build all these things. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I think you have to rely on these fuels for the time being, at least. Mm-hmm.
1-800-989-8255. Charlie in Sacramento. Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
First, I would like to say I really agree with you about hydrogen. I really think it is the way of the future, simply because it's not only renewable, but, you know, like you say, generate on the spot. My question was, in the way of renewable resources, why aren't we using, or couldn't we use as an interim, ethanol? Since I'm driving around in a 2000 Dodge minivan that has an engine that's spec'd to use ethanol right now. And as far as the dangers about hydrogen, I think it's laughable because I'm driving around on 4 sticks of dynamite as it is. I don't think hydrogen is going to be any more dangerous than gasoline we're using as it is.
Yeah.
Any comments, Susan, on ethanol?
Well, I think a lot of it boils down to the cost. How much does it cost to produce the ethanol, and what is it competing against? And you could use ethanol to produce hydrogen for fuel cells, but once again, you need to look at the cost of the reformation.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also an issue of availability. I seem to remember very dimly studies that were made looking at various feedstocks to use for fuel cells or even hydrogen engines, such as methanol, gasoline, ethanol, whatever. Ethanol, in principle, would be great because it is basically a biomass. In other words, it comes from plants which absorb the carbon dioxide. It can be made from plants which absorb the carbon dioxide of the atmosphere, therefore have a net zero cycle, if you will, if you can do that. But I seem to remember that the assessment was that there simply isn't enough ethanol around. It can be made to meet the needs of the entire transportation fleet in North America or the U.S. or whatever, however you want to define it. That seems to be a big problem with it. Mm-hmm.
Peter, how does... I'm sorry, go ahead, Lloyd.
I was just going to add, this actually highlights one of the real benefits of hydrogen. It may be in different parts of the world, you have a look at different feedstocks. So in places which may have a lot of ethanol, maybe such as Brazil, that may be a candidate for a feedstock. Other places where you've got a lot of renewables, which obviously is the way you're trying to aim, where you are aiming, then that's where you go. Other places, maybe it's obviously natural gas. So, and obviously you've got water plenty of places, or you've got methanol. Mm-hmm.
There are even people who don't like to call hydrogen a fuel. They sort of see it as a carrier of electricity.
Well, an energy carrier.
An energy carrier.
Electricity is also an energy carrier.
Yeah.
Again, yin and yang.
But Peter, how does the United States effort compared to other countries? You walk around the world. What's going on in other countries?
I don't walk that much around the world. I do most of my reporting by telephone from home.
So. You phone around the world.
I just had a story. I'm doing a story right now from Europe. Somebody sent me a file from Brussels on what they're doing. The numbers seem to be roughly equal in the three major areas, Europe, Japan, and the United States. There are differences. I think Japan, by and large, has been more aggressive over the years in pursuing this. Alan, correct me if I'm wrong. But in Europe, the latest what I just got from Europe was that they're trying to pull even with what the others are doing. But there seems to be a perception in Europe that there are too many complications in terms of the need for political accommodation among different countries, factions, economic situations, to make rapid progress. The United States is a politically more or less homogenous country where these things can be solved in Washington or in the States, and much somewhat more rapidly, even if it doesn't look that way from our perspective here. But Europe is much more complicated that way, and things are much more amorphous, diffuse, and more of a tendency to deliberate at great length before actually moving forward. But by and large, the funding levels seem to be roughly, very roughly comparable.
Could I add something?
Sure, Al. Go ahead.
California has benefited enormously from competition in the automotive industry, particularly the competition between the Detroit manufacturers, the Big Three, and the Japanese manufacturers. So we've had the benefit of much cleaner air, cleaner exhaust systems, and now we're seeing, in fact, that we've got the benefit of hybrids, which are, again, being sold in significant numbers by Toyota and Honda, and now they're beginning to catch on in Detroit. So I think that competition I see continuing, and I think it's going to be very healthy.
On the other hand, you see the Europeans way ahead of us on renewable energy like wind power or solar power. I mean, they've got all these, some of the countries. Look at Denmark.
Denmark, right.
Yeah, they're huge in that amount of...
Yeah, also, speaking of hydrogen production for wind, what Susan was referring to, there are a couple of instances where I know of one project in Norway where there's apparently a very large wind project underway, I think 200 or 300 megawatts, and there are plans underway to experimentally tap into this to make hydrogen to see how this works in real life. I don't think it's underway as yet or just beginning, but there are things underway. Also, I think, if I remember correctly, again, correct me if I'm wrong, there are the large wind farms at the eastern end of the Los Angeles basin. And I think there's a transit company, Sunline Transit, which is looking at the idea, or maybe it's beyond looking at, tapping into that wind power to make some hydrogen to fuel some of their experimental demonstration fuel cell buses.
That's exactly. They are using some renewable energy to refuel buses, correct.
Susan Hawk?
Yeah, I wanted to add here, I think a lot of the difference between Europe and the United States and how fast these technologies are progressing are due to the market that they're competing in. You know, in Europe, fuel costs are very high, and a lot of that's due to taxes and policies that the countries have implemented. And I think we need to remember that. And the role of our industry here in the United States is going to be so important in developing these hydrogen technologies, and I know the president's counting on them as being a major player in this whole effort. And the federal money is really just the seed to get a much, much larger effort going.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Will in Louisville. Hi, Will.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Hi. Yes, I had the pleasure of attending the Future Car Congress in 2002. In Arlington and driving some of these vehicles, and they are a reality. They're there, and they handle terrifically. And I was able to see some of Mr. Lloyd's comments, and you can also hear those comments on futurecarcongress.org. But it seems to me what I took away from that Congress was the fact that the storage of hydrogen in local and state laws, it's prohibited to be stored next to gasoline. Is that true?
I think there are significant permitting issues, in fact, which we are working through in cooperation with the partners, and you're correct. And one of the issues is some of those are local, and some of those can be specific. So I think it's a major education campaign with the local authority, the fire marshals, in fact, so that that can be addressed. You're right. And
we're talking about... I'm sorry. Let me just get my ID here. Let me jump in with the ID while I've got a second. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Sorry, Susan. Go ahead.
That's okay. I just wanted to add that, you know, the DOE program has recognized the importance of safety with hydrogen, and codes and standards is one of their highest priorities for developing quickly codes and standards so that local municipalities and states can permit projects.
There's a certain fear about hydrogen. I'm sure everybody has the vision of the Hindenburg in their head. But isn't it true that gasoline is much more explosive than hydrogen is?
Mm.
I mean, I talk to engineers people work in the industry, and they say gasoline is made to explode. That's how it works in the combustion chamber in your car, by exploding. Hydrogen just burns very rapidly.
Well, again, I'm not a technical expert, but that's my understanding as well. It's hydrogen burns much more rapidly. Hydrogen also burns in a much wider range of concentrations in air. I think it's from 4 to 74%. The same concentration range for gasoline and other fuels is apparently much narrower. The bottom line I always heard from people who look into safety is that, hydrogen is dangerous. Yeah, it is, but so is gasoline. It's just different. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen, for example, if you have an open hydrogen flame, you cannot see it. It's invisible practically. So people are thinking about adding colorants to hydrogen gas if you want to use it in, say, a domestic appliance, like analogous to natural gas, for example. There have been some theoretical studies saying that there was a big plane crash back in the 80s in the Mediterranean. I won't go into the details about there was one aircraft engineer was very much involved with hydrogen, said many more people would have walked away from that disaster, two jumbos colliding on a runway, if the planes would have been fueled by hydrogen, because essentially the kerosene, which was used then, burned for 10 hours and clung to the ground, and many people died in those flames. Hydrogen, which is very light, would have risen away out of harm's way. The people that would have been killed or injured would have been only the ones that were actually because of physical impact, but many others would have survived. At least this was a calculation based on the theoretical aspects of these things.
So go ahead, Susan.
I was going to say, I think we just need to learn new ways to interact with hydrogen. For instance, we'll put the storage tanks above the vehicle instead of below it.
Right.
And we're also doing a lot of work on sensors to developing new sensors that are extremely sensitive to measure small fractions of hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. We have an engineer out in Arizona named Roy McAllister, who's been on our program a couple of times. He's the head of the American Hydrogen Association. He drives a red pickup truck around with a tank of hydrogen in the back loading area for all to see. And he shows you, he's been driving it for 20 years, that, you know, he says he's convinced that it's a lot safer than having a tank of gasoline back there.
Yeah.
Well, also, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, a lot of work is ongoing. It's not that this hasn't been thought of. People are working on this. We have pipelines using hydrogen around refineries, different parts of the country, different parts of the world. And so a lot of work is ongoing. We've worked also with the Department of Transportation. They got work ongoing as well. So much more needs to be done, but this is already ongoing.
All right. We're going to take a little break, come back and talk lots more with Peter Hoffman, author of Tomorrow's Energy, Hydrogen Fuel Cells and Prospects for a Cleaner Planet, from MIT Press. Susan Hawk, Director of the Electric and Hydrogen Technologies and Systems Center at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Alan Lloyd, Chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. He's also Chairman of the California Air Resources Board. We'll take a short break, come back and take lots more of your questions. Stay on the line. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the hydrogen economy, what it would take to bring it about, with my guest Peter Hoffman, author of Tomorrow's Energy, Hydrogen Fuel Cells and Prospects for a Cleaner Planet, Susan Hawk of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, Alan Lloyd, chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Chris in eastern Minnesota. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Fine.
I have a question about the fuel cell cars. One of the benefits of going to hydrogen-based fuel cell is you don't have all the emissions that you do with gasoline, all the carbon emissions, and specifically carbon dioxide, which has been shown to be a pretty good greenhouse gas. But one of the emissions, if I understand it correctly, from a fuel cell is water vapor, which is even better acting as a greenhouse gas. And I wonder if that's been looked at, if by going to hydrogen cars, if we're going to be changing our environment in a way we might not thought of.
I think that has been looked at and recognized that you're actually producing a lot of water vapor in the typical car now and trucks. And in fact, if you look at the fuel cell, then you in fact ended up with a net benefit. So you end up with less water vapor.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you all of you a question. Where is the impetus? The president is sinking some money into this. I think $1.2 billion was the figure that was given out. Is that enough money? Is that enough impetus? Does private industry need that kind of impetus, or is it working well enough on its own? Let me ask you, Alan Lloyd, since you're involved with all these different companies.
Well, no. Clearly, I think again, I think it's a very good start from the president. If you're asking me if it's enough, clearly not. We need many more dollars than that. Also recognize that those dollars are typically 50% cost share, so the total dollars you're looking at is greater than that. The other part is, if you dump much more money in this right away, can you use those dollars effectively? Government is often accused of not using their resources most efficiently. You also have to look at a ramp up. So I think that making sure you're working with the companies, to develop this technology. The key from our viewpoint in California is to make sure that when that investment is made, when you have that government investment, that in fact you do see some product on the road. And that's a key part, so in fact the public gets the benefit both from the lower conventional emissions, lower greenhouse emissions, and ultimately zero.
Watching these new cars and fuel cells come online, have you got a favorite? I know you're never going to give me a favorite. You don't want to insult anybody. But can you look for us to tell us who you think the forward-looking car companies are and you know, what we might expect in the future?
God, well, I mean, years ago I drove the Daimler Chrysler Neckar 4, which is a car not sold in this country. It's a very tiny, I was going to say, it looks like a mini-mini or a nano-mini. And that was very impressive. Just a couple of weeks ago, I drove both this new General Motors Highwire, which was a little ratchety in its steering, but I also drove General Motors' so-called Hydrogen 3, which is based on a production car made by Opel, the GM subsidiary in Germany, called the Zafira. And that thing was smooth as silk and wonderful, and the test engineers was German. I'm German. He said, put the metal to the petrol, drive it fast. So I did about 60 kilometers an hour on this one-third of a mile little track through a park in Sacramento. And as far as I could tell, it was as well-performing and as problem-free as any production car.
Was that a fuel cell?
It was a fuel cell car, right. And the interesting thing about that car was one of the engineers told me, by now in the third generation of that vehicle, they have developed the fuel cell package in such a configuration, such a physical shape, that it fits seamlessly into the place that's now occupied by the conventional engine. So in other words, they could take this car theoretically, and if they had serious productions of fuel cells, which they don't have so far, and dump them right in and make these cars run and sell.
Wow.
I think the other thing to recognize is that typically you see each iteration getting better.
Right.
So
absolutely.
If you go back to the old vehicles, now the newer ones, and if you test drive the newest Toyota and Honda, both of which, by the way, are hybrids. The Toyota's got a battery with a fuel cell, the Honda with an ultracapacitor and a fuel cell. They're extremely smooth.
I'd like to also bring in another guest at this point, Congressman Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, representing the 7th District and senior member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Welcome to the program, Congressman.
Thank you for having me on.
What is your what was your reaction to the president's speech about hydrogen economy?
Well, my reaction was that it will be a wonderful day when someone figures out how to do it. But why doesn't the president do something right now about the fuel economy standards for SUVs and automobiles, since we've slipped back now to an average that it was being met in 1981 in the United States? So I guess, while I hope, as many people do, that the day will arrive when we can have a hydrogen-based automobile, that the president right now has the ability to do something about fuel economy standards, something about something immediately to do about emissions into the atmosphere, but he, in both of those instances, is actually objecting to any progress being made today.
So you think that this is a half-hearted effort by the president?
I actually believe that it is a very deceptive act by this administration. Rather than taking existing technology, which does make it possible today to improve dramatically the fuel economy standards of SUVs and mandating that the auto industry implement that. Instead, what he does is he proposes some dream technology a generation from now, which avoids this generation having to make the tough decisions to force the auto industry to improve the fuel economy standards today, which reduce pollution and reduce our oil imports from the Middle East.
So you're saying his reference to a child born today driving a hydrogen-powered car when he grows up is a little too far in the future?
I think that it may be possible that a child born today will drive that vehicle, and I hope it comes to pass, but that doesn't relieve this generation of the responsibility of ensuring that the vehicles that we drive while we're alive are as fuel efficient as they can be. We're sending 200 to 250,000 young men and women over to the Middle East to fight a war which is at least partly about oil. And I just think it's not morally justifiable for us at home not to attempt to simultaneously reduce our dependence upon that oil, and as a result, perhaps reduce our long-term necessity to go to war over oil.
But you think though that the idea of a hydrogen economy is a good one?
I think the idea of a hydrogen economy is great. I also believe that the idea of cheese pizzas, which don't cause heart disease, is a good idea. There are many great ideas that I hope someday in the long distant future that we can actually discover. But right now, I wouldn't start eating two cheese pizzas a day with the hope that we would cure whatever the consequences of that were 16 years from now. Likewise, I wouldn't avoid ensuring that our SUVs and automobiles dramatically increase their fuel economy standards today because I hope that 16 or 20 or 30 years from now we will have a hydrogen-powered vehicle, because that just avoids dealing with the reality of the problems that are going to be created from our present conduct.
Congressman, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Congressman Edward Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts and senior member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. We're also joined this hour by Peter Hoffman, who is the editor of Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Letter. Susan Hawk was with the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. Alan Lloyd, chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. Any of you agree with what the congressman was saying?
Well, I have a little reservation or really a comment or an add-on, if you will. It may well be that the administration should put for more improved efficiency standards right now on conventional internal combustion engines, but I must say, I'm not a spokesman for General Motors by any means. I'm by definition probably more left-wing liberal rather than anything else than Republican. But I was impressed by what I saw at this display in Sacramento from General Motors. They had a whole bunch of alternative engine technologies for internal combustion engines, with efficiencies improvements between 8, 11, 1, a small diesel, 30%. In some of them, this included such a thing as displacement demand. In other words, you shut down half your cylinders at highway speeds. Variable transmissions, which have the efficiency of a manual, but the smoothness of an automatic. The clean diesel hybrids, as somebody else mentioned before. So, I mean, some of these cars will be available or are available now. Some of them will come commercially available at the end of next year or the year after. There will be an extra cost, to be sure. It's a new technology, from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. But what I'm saying is that obviously the car makers have taken at least some of this stuff to heart, mm-hmm. and have done something to improve these things at a cost, admittedly, but it's new technology, and they have not been totally static.
All right. We're talking about hydrogen fuel economy this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Of course, on the other hand, let me just jump in for a second and say, on the other hand, at the Detroit Auto Show, GM showed off a 1,000 horsepower right. Cadillac 16 Monster.
Oh, yeah, right.
So,
yeah, I mean, it's a.
And SUVs are still 50% of the cars that are being
right.
sold.
Right, oh, yeah, fork tongues or whatever.
Were those model cars you saw, those energy efficient ones, were they SUVs?
Well, there were a couple of vans. The diesel, interestingly enough, was a small Fiat, which has some ties to General Motors. Apparently, will have more ties.
Let me get Alan Lloyd. We have to go. Alan wants to jump in here. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, what I want to say, I don't think it's either or. I think we should look at both.
Right.
And I think it's too bad that, in fact, we haven't got more emphasis on increasing the fuel efficiency, the fuel economy there with those vehicles, while at the same time we can be working on the hydrogen, towards the hydrogen economy. And I think in California spoke very strongly last year when they looked at the need to reduce greenhouse gases, for the recognition that we need to have more efficiency in the car side, reducing all the greenhouse gases, of course the major one being CO2.
But California keeps getting sued by the car makers about the zero emission vehicles.
Well, I think they're sued on one particular part of that. And so, yes, we're trying to work with them more cooperatively. That's the beauty of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. So I'm doing my best to actually, if you like, work together rather than try to work against the lawyers.
Susan Hockland, I was out there in Golden at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. I saw, I think it was a Prius in the parking lot there, one of these hybrid cars.
Right. I think we have several that we use on site to get our staff around from different buildings. And I think there's a large percentage of our staff that have also purchased hybrid vehicles for their own personal use, and they're very happy with them.
Mm-hmm. So you're optimistic then?
Sure.
Are you all as optimistic as Susan is?
Well, yeah. I mean, by and large, yes. I mean, it's very, as so many things, it happens two steps forward, one backward, you know. But overall, I mean, when I think of what, when I first started writing about hydrogen fuel cells 25 years ago or so, it was sort of science fiction stuff, you know. Yeah. Nobody said, my God, this is weird, you know.
Well, the fuel cell was patented in 1839, so it's been around a while.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Alan, last word.
Yeah, well, I think while I'm optimistic, I'm still also a realist. So we must make sure we have much better cooperation from the auto companies to make these technologies a reality and not just a figment here. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's very important. We have the checks and balances.
That's one thing to have all these demonstration cars. It's another thing to get them on the road.
That's exactly right.
Isn't it right? All right. Thank you all for joining me. Alan Lloyd is chairman of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. He's also chairman of the California Air Resources Board. Susan Hawk is director of the Electric and Hydrogen Technologies and Systems Center at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. She was also the lab's wind energy technology manager from 1992 to 2002. Peter Hoffman is the editor of the Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Letter and author of Tomorrow's Energy, Hydrogen, Fuel Cells, and the Prospects for a Cleaner Planet. That's out from MIT Press. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn, from Ed Trudeau in Denver, Terry Joy in Reno. If you have comments or questions, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can leave us email. Any of the links we talked about, you didn't get your pencil out fast enough, we've got the links on sciencefriday.com. You can also surf over to those sites. We also have Science Friday's Kids Connection, which has, the curricula based on Science Friday. And also we have archived Science Friday programs that you could download into your portable player, digital player, and take them with you and listen to them when you'd like to. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.